This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Cancer may be the disease Americans fear most, and yet each region of the country has a different profile when it comes to this illness, reflecting that area's particular demographics, lifestyles, and environmental factors. For example, here in New Hampshire, bladder cancer among men is quite high, about 20% more than the national average, while women here have higher rates of uterine cancer. And overall, Granite Staters are more likely to get lung cancer than Americans in general and are more likely to die from it. According to the New Hampshire Comprehensive Cancer Collaboration, lung cancer alone kills more Granite Staters than the next three most common kinds combined: colon, breast, and prostate. Today in The Exchange, Mapping Cancer in New Hampshire, the first of a two-part series. This hour, we'll examine what types of cancer people here tend to get and why. Next week, we'll get the latest on treatments and the search for a cure. So let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. With us for the hour is Judy Reese, director of the New Hampshire Cancer Registry. She's also an assistant professor of epidemiology at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College. And Judy, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
How has our understanding, Judy, of cancer changed over time?
Well, I think we've known about cancer in history. It's been known about for thousands of years. And originally, people thought about cancer as a single disease. And then over time, it became a disease which affected certain organs. So you see historical references to breast cancer and lung cancer. But I don't think we had any particular idea that these were different diseases until science really took hold and we could look at tumors under the microscope and see differences between the types of tumor that affected people even within a single part of the body. So, for example, breast cancer originally might have been thought of as a single disease. And then over time, we got more of a clue about the molecular characteristics of it and some sense that hormones played a role in the development of some breast cancers. And then gradually we've been able to do much more sophisticated things like sequence the DNA in a tumor and identify the proteins and receptors on a tumor's cells. And that way we can subdivide breast cancer into a whole load of different subtypes. And now we think of breast cancer, which once was a single disease, we think of it now as hundreds of different diseases.
Just in breast cancer alone, never mind prostate, lung, bladder, all the other types.
Right. And so when we look at historical trends and we just look at breast cancer rates of new diagnoses, we're actually looking at a much more complex picture than we used to imagine. And the differences between the tumors are very important in determining the treatment that people get and the prognosis that they have, so the outcomes.
Oh, that's interesting. So as we understand cancer isn't just, you know, all one, as we get more specific and more particular, we can target treatments to that specific characteristic.
Right, exactly. And with breast cancer, for example, we know about estrogen receptors, progesterone receptors, and a protein called HER2, which these are the commonest characteristics of the breast cancers that we look at. And according to which subtype people have got, that will determine what the treatment would be. But you can also look at some of those characteristics across tumors. So, for example, HER2, which occurs in maybe 20 to 30% of breast cancers, also occurs in 20% of gastric cancers. So it seems slightly odd, but stomach cancers also have this same characteristic. So it's a very complicated picture now.
You are, as I said, director of the New Hampshire Cancer Registry. What is that specifically, Judy?
The Cancer Registry is it's an organization that collects, systematically collects information about cancers in a geographic region. And we've had cancer registries around. I think Yale had the first one maybe 90 years ago. And the idea is to collect the data in such a way that we can actually give people incidence rates for the whole state. So if we know what the incidence is in the whole state, we can then look at patterns in the incidence. So it's very important to collect the data well and to make sure that you don't systematically miss cancers, for example. But the larger hospitals in the state all collect cancer data themselves because they have certain obligations about quality control. And so they're all collecting the data, and then the central state registry collects it together, and we produce statistics for the state, and then we contribute de-identified data to the CDC, and they produce statistics for the whole country.
Well, and those patterns are interesting. I'm going to talk about those a lot this hour because there are some cancers that are more prevalent here in New Hampshire than in other parts of the country, some less. So it's real interesting, and it does give you sort of a window into who we are and our lifestyles, our environment, and so forth. But before we get into the individual types of cancers, Judy, what is New Hampshire's overall cancer burden, meaning the rates at which people here get it and the rates at which they die from it?
Yeah, so in New Hampshire, we see about 7,500 new cases of cancer per year, and about 2,600 people die of cancer each year. The rates in men are higher than in women, and that's not unusual. That happens nationally as well.
Really? Men tend to get cancer more than women?
Yeah, and then the age association is obviously very important. So about probably maybe 6,500, 7,000 of the cases will be in older people, say over 50 or over 60, and then the remainder are in younger people.
So 7,500 people get diagnosed with cancer every year,
right?
And 2,600 people die from it every year.
Right. And those are the reportable cancers. So there's a list of the types of cancer that are collected. And there's another type, which we may talk about later, which is the non-melanoma skin cancers. And those are extremely common, but they're not on the reportable list. They do tend to be less serious in terms of the outcomes. And if you look at the numbers in the country, for example, there are about 1.7 million new cancers a year in the whole country. But if you then add in these non-melanoma skin cancers, you have to add in about another 3 million.
Wow, it's
so,
a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Well, and a little bit later, we've got somebody who's been working on that particular issue. So setting that aside just for the moment, this overall cancer burden, you gave us the numbers, 7,500 new cases every year, 2,600 people dying every year. Just here in this little state of New Hampshire, it seems like a lot. How does that compare nationally? Do we have a worse cancer burden to bear than many other states, Judy?
We do have about 8% higher rates here. The Northeast in general has higher rates, so I can't say that it's New Hampshire specifically, but if you look at a map, actually, I teach medical students at Dartmouth, and I show them a map each year, which has a sort of color-coded gradation for the cancer rates. And you can see that in the South, some of the rates, like colon cancer, for example, are a lot lower in the southern states than they are in the northern states. And some people wonder whether this is associated with vitamin D exposure, because the sun in the South presumably is giving people more vitamin D. So so when you look at maps of the whole country, you can see a lot of different patterns there. And the opposite pattern for melanoma. So in the South, they are seeing generally more melanomas, except that up here in the Northeast, we have a little pocket of high melanomas too.
Because of tanning beds, which we'll talk about in a minute. But overall, maybe the Northeast has higher cancer rates than the rest of the country?
Yes.
Why is that? Is it because we're older or
well,
what?
These rates are adjusted for age.
I see.
So even if we do have an older population in New Hampshire, but the rates have already been adjusted for that. So we still have a higher rate. And we have to think of 20, 30, 40 different reasons why that might be the case. There are certain lifestyle factors, for example, environmental factors. There may be issues with screening, cancer screening, prevention, for example, HPV vaccination. some things which we don't track at the registry, like genetics. So if there are predispositions to cancer through genetics, we actually can't track that. But there are a whole range of reasons why cancers could be higher in New Hampshire. And it may actually be that every specific cancer that you look at has a different reason behind it. So we'll talk about arsenic and bladder cancer. We might talk about radon and lung cancer. I don't think there'll be one size fits all here. There's another issue, which is probably a small factor, but it probably is worth saying, which is that as registries collect cancer to a higher quality, that does mean that there'll be large numbers of cases. So we do have high quality data at the New Hampshire Cancer Registry. And if we then compare the data with national figures, and perhaps some states do less well at collecting their cancers, then we're going to look higher anyway.
So that makes me feel a little bit better.
That
our data quality is good. I also wonder about the screening that you mentioned. We're a relatively high-income state, so I would think that more people would have better access to health care, and that would mean more screening. And, you know, the more you screen, the more you find.
Right. And I think that one thing that strikes me with screening is that there are different types of screening. So if we look, for example, at breast cancer, when we do mammography, we're going to find early-stage breast cancers or pre-invasive, the in situs. So I think if you do a good job with mammography screening, you will push your rates up because you find more cancers. And that might be true also of prostate cancer, because there was a vogue in the 90s for doing a lot of PSA screening, so the prostate-specific antigen, which is a marker of increased size of the prostate. That became very trendy, and testing for PSA actually pushed the rates right up. So there's a peak of prostate cancer rates nationally in the mid-90s. But on the other hand, there are types of screening which, if they're done effectively, will push down the rates of cancer. So, for example, in New Hampshire, we have on the low side our rates for colorectal cancer and cancer of the cervix. And it's interesting because those two cancers, if the screening is done well, you actually will remove pre-invasive lesions. So you'll push your rates down. So I think it's actually quite interesting that we have high rates of mammography and prostate cancer where screening pushes rates up, but we have lower rates of cancer of the cervix and colorectal cancer, because if you have a colonoscopy and a polyp is found, that's not a cancer. That's a lesion that can be removed, and in some cases it would have turned into a cancer. But by screening and removing those, you will push the rates down, and that's the goal of colorectal. And the same for cervix. You try to identify through a pap smear your pre-invasive, not cancerous cells, and treat them before they become cancer. So actually, New Hampshire's rates of those two cancers is lower, and so that's actually encouraging.
The phone number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, the first in a two-part series, we're mapping cancer here in the Granite State. And this hour, we're delving into just what the disease looks like here, including the most prevalent cancers. Next week, we'll look more at treatment and cure. Right now, though, we're just getting an idea of what cancer looks like here in New Hampshire. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. I want to focus in, Judy, on one type of cancer that shows up at higher than average rates here in New Hampshire, and that's bladder cancer. With us now for more on that is Dr. Margaret Karagas. She's chair of the Department of Epidemiology at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College. And Dr. Karagas, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
How much higher are New Hampshire's bladder cancer rates, Dr. Karagas, compared to national numbers? Are we a lot higher or a little higher?
They're about 40% higher in New Hampshire compared to the rest of the U.S. And what's really noticeable is if you look at a map of bladder cancer mortality rates for the entire country, you see a hot spot where the rates have been higher in northern New England since the 1950s. So that's over half a century.
Wow. So that's a lot higher than the rest of the country.
Yeah.
So the big question, Dr. Karagas, and maybe you don't know, but I could ask anyway, I mean, why would that be the case? Why would northern New England in particular have these alarmingly high rates of bladder cancer?
Well, since this pattern has persisted for so long, and it's present among both men and women, we began to question, well, whether there's something in the local environment that's causing it. And one of the unique features of our region is that many of us rely on a private well. So over a third of the population in New Hampshire uses a private water supply or a well. And so these private water systems are ones that serve fewer than 15 households or 25 individuals, and they're not regulated or monitored for contaminants like public water that's provided in towns and cities that are routinely tested. And in our studies, we found that over 10% of these wells contain arsenic above the U.S. safe drinking water standard.
So arsenic from private well water may be the cause.
That's one thing. We know that arsenic can cause bladder cancer in places with extremely high levels of contamination, like in the southwest of Taiwan and a northern region of Chile. And we actually conducted a study in New Hampshire, Vermont, and Maine, and we did find that cumulative exposure to arsenic through drinking water was associated with an increased risk of bladder cancer, particularly if it was 40 or more years prior to the diagnosis. And then an intriguing finding from our study also was people who drank from a dug well, so these are shallower wells, and especially prior to the 1960s, these aren't as commonly used anymore. Now most people have these deeper drilled wells. Prior to the 60s, arsenical chemicals were being used in agriculture. So these preceded those organic pesticides that are used today.
So those would have gotten into the well water.
They could have potentially gotten into the well water.
So here's a question for you, Dr. Karagus. Again, just going over the numbers to prepare for today, I was surprised about this bladder cancer number. You hear so much about, you know, breast cancer, and there's breast cancer walks and awareness, and you hear a lot about prostate cancer, and I certainly have gotten the message about cervical cancer and colon cancer. You hear almost nothing about bladder cancer. How surprising is that, given the high rates that we have here in the Northeast, especially Northern New England?
Well, most people present with kind of a painless blood in their urine, and they're diagnosed at a fairly early stage, which will carry a favorable prognosis. But the problem is that over half of the treated cases will recur, and they can progress to a more advanced stage. So patients need to be pretty aggressively medically followed. And so that's what makes bladder cancer actually one of the most costly cancers to treat. And that's why we need to understand the causes of bladder cancer in order to prevent the cancer from ever occurring.
So it's pretty treatable early on, but then it also has a high rate of reoccurrence.
Yes.
Why do you think there is less information out there about the relatively high threat of bladder cancer here in New Hampshire? Again, I think this is news for a lot of people.
Well, I think what we're trying to get out the message is for people who use a private well and have private water systems to have their water tested for arsenic and other contaminants. And hopefully this will shift the curve downward for us. Or help to.
Well, and in a moment, Dr. Karagus, I want to ask you about another type of cancer that you're working on, some types of skin cancer. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. And we'll start taking your questions and comments, too, at 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, mapping cancer in New Hampshire. We're looking at the kinds of cancers that Granite Staters tend to get and some of the possible reasons why. Next week, we'll look more closely at treatment and the search for a cure for cancer. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Post a comment on our Facebook page. Find us on Twitter. Our guest for the hour is Judy Reese. She's director of New Hampshire's Cancer Registry. She's also an assistant professor of epidemiology at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College. And with us for a few more minutes on the line is Dr. Margaret Karagas. She's chair of the Department of Epidemiology at the Geisel School. And Dr. Karagas, we were talking with you about bladder cancer and the relatively high rates here in New Hampshire. You also work on some types of skin cancer. Now, not the one most people have heard of, melanoma. What kinds of skin cancer are you studying, Dr. Karagas?
So I study the forms of skin cancer that are derived from keratinocytes in the skin, not the melanocytes or the pigment cells that are associated with melanomas. So these are called basal cell and squamous cell carcinomas, and are the most common forms of cancer in humans. They occur more commonly than all cancers combined,
wow,
including in New Hampshire.
So, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, we're one of the few places in the world that are actually monitoring the occurrence of these cancers, thanks to the commitment and collaboration of our dermatologists and pathologists in our state. So we have really good data in New Hampshire on these malignancies.
So basal and squamous, those are the two types of skin cancer that you're looking at. Are those caused by something inherently genetic about a particular person, or are these brought on by too much sun exposure?
Well, most cancers and most diseases have a genetic and an environmental component. So skin cancers, yes, there's definitely a genetic component, multiple genetic components, including our pigment, which is genetically driven. But sunlight is a dominant factor that we're all aware of. And, yep.
So in terms of these two types of skin cancers, again, what are we seeing here in New Hampshire? The tendency to think is, well, you know, summer's pretty short, winter is long, so maybe we don't need to worry about this.
Well, we've seen increasing incidence rates in New Hampshire. And
really?
It's been reported in other regions of the world as well.
And why is that?
Well, we're not sure. One of the findings we have from our study that's important is that indoor tanning increases the risk of these malignancies. In particular, the younger you are when you start using a tanning lamp, the more likely you are to develop a skin cancer at an early age.
How much do you think that message is getting out there, Dr. Karagas? I came across a number yesterday. I think 20 or 25% of New England women use tanning beds.
Yeah, I think it's an alarming prevalence, and we're trying to get the word out. We're trying to get pediatricians to talk to young people about it. You know, we're really concerned about early exposure and protecting children and adolescents who are most vulnerable. And even with respect to sunlight, you know, protecting babies and infants and children as well.
You know, I have to ask you this, Dr. Karagas, and Judy, jump in if you want to as well. We, the general public, have been getting that sunscreen message for some time now. But more recently, Dr. Karagas, you hear about Northern New Englanders being vitamin D deficient, that some of us don't get enough sunshine. So, you know, from just a regular person perspective, how do we figure this out, the benefits of the sun versus the risks of the sun? And go ahead, Dr. Karagas, you first.
Well, this is a controversial topic. My understanding is you don't need a lot of the skin surface to be exposed to the sun for very long in summer to acquire a sufficient vitamin D level. So even if you wear a hat and put on sunscreen, you get enough. But on the other hand, you need to protect yourself from getting a sunburn to prevent all the major forms of skin cancer, including melanoma.
It sounds like you're leaning in the direction of risks outweigh the benefits.
Right. But if people are concerned, they may want to talk to their healthcare provider if they need, you know, vitamin D supplements, if they don't go out in the sun at all or during the winter months.
Okay. Well, Dr. Karagas, it's been good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
That's Dr. Margaret Karagas, chair of the Department of Epidemiology at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College. One more time, the exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Judy Reese, before we go to our listeners, just other things that you think people here need to know about skin cancer, whether the two types that Dr. Carrigas talked about or the more well-known type, melanoma?
Yeah, I think I would also agree about the moderation in the sun exposure. I mean, I think that during the winter, we don't have any chance to get out there and get some vitamin D from our skin, which is where the body makes vitamin D. And I certainly give my kids some supplements during the winter. But during the summer, I think as long as you're not overdoing it, I think it's fine to get out there a little bit. But, you know, you don't need to get suntanned or sunburned to get vitamin D. And I think that's probably a message I would put across. I mean, the squamous cell and the basal cell are relatively the less aggressive of the skin cancers, but melanoma can be very aggressive. And in New Hampshire, we've definitely got higher rates of melanoma than the rest of the country.
Which I find really, really surprising.
And I don't know exactly why that is, except perhaps that people are getting out there in the summer because they're so fed up after the winter.
Well, yeah.
But the rates are high among a couple of different groups. I think that the older men tend to get more melanomas. And some of that may be occupational. I mean, even driving here, you see a lot of people out on the roads that are working outdoors. And it's part of their occupation. They have a great, you know, very deep suntan, and they're probably at greater risk of getting a melanoma. But the other group that was found in a study that the Department of Environmental Services did a few years ago was women in the 18 to 35 year age group. And the disproportionately high rates of melanoma in that group is a little concerning, especially in terms of the indoor tanning. So I think anything that we can do to help bring the message to high schoolers about maybe trying to avoid the indoor tanning as much as possible, I think would be useful. And the New Hampshire Comprehensive Cancer Collaboration has been doing some work to try to increase awareness of that. So they go out into high schools and do some promotion for that kind of information.
Again, the phone number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Judy, let's go to our listeners. And Ray is joining us from Litchfield. Hi, Ray. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Recently, I've been diagnosed with cancer, late last year, and I've been receiving some like six rounds of treatment. But my question is in regards to the present initiative, the Cancer Moonshot, as he calls it.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah.
Joe Biden is in charge of the moonshot to find a cure.
Yeah, and your guest kind of touched a little bit on one of the aspects, and that was, data at the hospitals and sharing it. But what you're talking about is big data, collecting from all over the world, all the different treatments, all the different cancers and things like that. And does your guest have any information about that? And you think actually collecting more of that information would be helpful?
You know, first of all, Ray, I'm sorry to hear about your diagnosis. What kind of cancer, if I may ask?
It's multiple myeloma, a form of blood cancer.
Okay. Well, good luck. And please join us next week, Ray. Listen in, because we're going to talk more about treatment and cure next week. But I love that he asked about this moonshot to cure cancer that President Obama talked about recently. In terms of the data, Judy, again, you're not a treatment specialist, but you are looking broadly. What do we need more to know so that we can achieve this, ultimate cure? I mean, that's everybody's hope.
Yeah, I think that there are people who are working on the big data angle, and I think it's very important that they do that, because particularly with the rare cancers, the more you can pool data from different sources, the more you're going to be able to draw some inferences about what works and what doesn't. So that's what we call observational data. So we can collect at the cancer registry level, we can collect information about the diagnosis and the initial treatment. But really what the listener is referring to is something beyond what the cancer registry does, and that is really detailed treatment data, including the drugs and the doses and when they're given and how people respond to them. And I think that you're right that If we could do that, we would get a lot more out of it than just the straightforward cancer registry data. And there are people working to do that. There's a researcher at Dartmouth, Chris Amos, who is working on multiple projects where data are pooled, particularly genetics data. And I think the kind of informatics approach to cancer is going to really take off.
Well, and thank you for the call, Ray. It's a great question. And again, please join us next week as we look more at treatment and the search for a cure. Quick question for you, Judy. How much of a role does genetics play in cancer? Genetics being, you know, family history or just my own particular individual genetics, you know, whether I'm pre-programmed or not. And part of the reason I ask is we often hear that there are lifestyle factors involved with cancer. I know several people who've died of cancer recently who had impeccable lifestyles. So you just wonder about that.
Yeah, I think that a little bit is known about the genetics, but not enough at this point. There are known, well-described syndromes like Lynch syndrome, where people are at increased risk of multiple cancers. But at the individual level, you have to wonder, we're all exposed every day to a whole lot of chemicals, and probably a lot of them are carcinogenic, but we don't all get cancer. And so you must wonder what the interaction is between genetics and the environment. And there are people working on that, but I think it's just a big pot of you know, data that you have to try and untangle in some way. That is an important focus, I think, for cancer researchers, is the interaction between genes and environment. And ultimately, I think we're going to figure out a lot more about our own individual risks based on our own personal genetic makeup.
Let's take another call. And Arthur is in Lee. Hi, Arthur. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me. My question is, there's been a lot of talk about radon, and I wondered if that, what effect that might have had, especially, I think, in the new houses where they're so well sealed that they have to have some kind of an air-to-air heat exchanger to...
Well, Arthur, I'm so glad. Yeah, I'm so glad you called, because radon is a factor naturally occurring, you know, in the granite of the Granite State. Is radon linked to any of the cancers that we've talked about, Judy, so far this hour? The
yeah.
bladder cancer, the lung cancer, and so forth?
Yeah, radon is a big issue, not only throughout the country, but particularly, I think, in the Northeast. So radon is thought to account for 14% of lung cancers. So
wow.
That's actually a high, you know, it's a lot. And the problem with radon is you can't smell it, you can't see it, you don't know it's there. And I've seen estimates that one house in 15 may have a problem with radon. So it's very important that people do test. It's relatively cheap to test. I think you can buy a kit out in the hardware store for $10 to $20 and test it. But it's also important to test that in the right way, because you must follow the instructions. If you put the little test kit out and then open the windows, the radon's all going to go outdoors and you're going to get a false negative on your radon test. And actually that happened to me when we bought our house. The seller gave me a normal radon test. I did it myself and I found that it was high. So if I'd have gone with the first result, I wouldn't have mitigated the house for radon. But I did the test properly with the doors and the windows all closed up and the result came back high. So it's important to test it properly. And in New Hampshire, it's been estimated that there may be 78,000 homes out there that have a problem with radon that people don't know about. So it is something that people should be thinking about. In those 78,000 homes, there are probably 200,000 people living, and they may
That's
be
a lot
exposed.
Of people.
Yeah, they may be exposed to radon. So it may be that we've got 100 cancers a year in New Hampshire, lung cancers that are attributable to radon. You can also test radon in the water, and that's important to do because it's associated with stomach cancer as well.
Speaking of lung cancer, we're joined now by Lance Bushy. He's Director of Public Policy for the American Lung Association in New Hampshire. And Lance Bushy, welcome. Thanks for your time.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, I was looking at, again, some of the numbers, and it turns out New Hampshire has significantly high rates of lung cancer here, according to the New Hampshire Comprehensive Cancer Collaboration. Lung cancer alone kills more granite stages than the next three most common cancers combined: colon, breast, and prostate. I have to say, Lance, I was surprised by this. How should we figure this out?
Well, I don't think you're really alone by being surprised by it. The stats really are both stunning and sobering, and lung cancer is the leading cancer killer in both men and women. And what we're seeing here in New Hampshire for both lung cancer incidents and death rates is that they trend slightly higher than the national average, but really we do find that most people are surprised by this.
Well, and among men, it's 81 cases per 100,000 residents versus 70 nationally. That's a big difference. Among women, it's 62 cases per 100,000 residents versus 54 nationally. How much is this due to smoking, Lance? I mean, most people think, well, if I don't smoke, I won't get lung cancer. I'm all good.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to note that smoking is the leading cause of lung cancer. But what we're going to talk about other risk factors shortly, but it's the bottom line is anyone with lungs can get lung cancer. And whether someone smokes or not, they don't deserve lung cancer. But it does contribute to 80% of lung cancer deaths in men and 90% of lung cancer deaths in women. So it is obviously the leading risk factor that is modifiable that we need to address to address this epidemic.
So smoking is still, you know, a giant cause, you're saying, Lance. Other factors, air quality, radon that Judy mentioned, what else might be leading to these significantly higher rates of lung cancer here in the Granite State?
Radon is the second leading cause. Nationally, it's estimated at 21,000 lung cancer deaths a year. And as the previous guest was talking about, it's a lot of people don't realize the impacts of radon. It's a colorless, odorless, tasteless gas and has no immediate symptoms. But much of the housing stock in New Hampshire is at risk for high levels of radon. And new construction as well can be sealed so tightly that it can present a radon problem as well.
Oh, that's interesting. So older, leakier houses like mine might not hold in more as much radon as a brand new house.
It definitely, I mean, it could let in more radon through your foundation or basement. About 8 years ago, the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services mapped 24,000 homes tested in New Hampshire, and there were pockets of the Granite State that have a higher concentration of levels of radon that are of concern, which is a level of 4. Picocuries per liter in the air, and the counties of Coos, Carroll, Grafton, Rockingham, so sort of the northern and eastern counties of radon had some areas had houses that 50% of the homes tested at a actionable level of radon.
All right. Well, Lance, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
No problem.
That's Lance Bushy. He's Director of Public Policy for the American Lung Association in New Hampshire. Coming up, we'll take a lot more of your questions and comments as we map cancer here in the Granite State. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at cancer trends here in New Hampshire and some of the possible contributing factors from demographics to environmental. Join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. This hour, we're mapping cancer in the Granite State, finding out what the most prevalent cancers are here in New Hampshire and what some of the contributing factors might be. Next week, we'll look more at treatment and cure. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. With me for the hour, Judy Reese, Director of the New Hampshire Cancer Registry. She's also an assistant professor of epidemiology at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College. And Judy, we've talked a lot about possible contributing factors. We talked about sun exposure. We talked about smoking. We talked about radon. We talked about arsenic. How much of cancer, Judy, do we know is due to lifestyle choices? Obesity, lack of exercise, diet, and so forth.
Yeah, I've heard that some people attribute about a third of cancers to those nutrition, exercise, and overweight.
That's a lot.
It's actually a very big impact. And in New Hampshire, based on some of the survey data that people do, we're not worse than the national levels of activity and nutrition. We're maybe a couple points better in some cases. But I think with only about a third of New Hampshire at a healthy weight, I think we do have a way to go.
Only a third of New Hampshire is at a healthy weight.
Yeah.
Wow. And what types of cancers are connected to those factors, the lack of exercise and poor nutrition?
Yeah, I think there are actually a lot. I mean, one of the ones we have in New Hampshire that's a higher rate is cancer of the uterus, and that is certainly one that's associated with overweight. But I think that overweight is one of those general risk factors that affects a lot of different cancers. Nutrition is a little different insofar as people may have certain quirks to their diet and maybe have a particular deficit in terms of what they're not eating. But the overweight issue, I think, is just a general risk factor for a lot of different cancers.
It's interesting because we often think about being overweight and not exercising as a factor for heart disease and diabetes, but less so cancer.
Right. And actually, in a lot of states, heart disease is the main cause of death at the state level. But in New Hampshire, we've actually overtaken that. So cancer is now the leading cause of death in New Hampshire and in some surrounding states as well. The rates of both are going down. So I think we're doing some things well. But the rate of heart disease in general in this corner of the country is going down faster than the rate of cancer is going down. So now cancer is the leading cause of death.
So that's interesting. So heart disease used to be the leading cause of death. Now it's cancer, and it's hard to find some good news in that. But the good news is, it sounds like heart disease is going down. So,
yeah, I think there are certain things that are, I mean, that's a different field, but there are certain things that nationally people are doing better to prevent heart disease. But in New Hampshire, we now have a bigger problem in terms of mortality with cancer.
Our phone number again for you to join us as we map cancer in the Granite State is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Don joins us from Sandwich. Hi, Don. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
How are you this morning?
Fine. Go ahead, Don.
Okay. My question quickly is simply this. We are a skiing state, and so many of us ski. And I'm wondering if the effects of the sun's rays are affected by the reflection off snow. Is it worse? Is it better?
Yeah.
And as to,
yeah, go ahead, Don. Sorry.
As to lung cancer, the effect on greater numbers, to what extent might that be that so many of the men have worked and had asbestos exposure at the naval yard? Thank you.
Okay. And I don't know if we can answer the naval yard question because that sounds like a very specific area of research that I'm guessing you haven't tackled, Judy, things that you do.
Yeah, I mean, asbestos is known to be associated with a certain type of lung cancer called mesothelioma, but I don't have any knowledge about the shipyard itself.
And what about his question? And again, you may not know, Judy, sometimes it does seem when you're out skiing that the sun is, you know, doubly bright. You get it from above and you get it from below.
Yeah, I definitely think that's a risky pastime in the winter. It's a great pastime. And really all you have to do is put sunscreen on. And as a child, I would go skiing in the winter. And I remember getting a blistered face, which is
really
a real no-no for skin care. But yes, you're a little higher because you're up there, a bit of altitude, and you're skiing in the wind and the sun. So, yes, I certainly think that's a risk for melanoma on the face.
Well, Don, thank you for calling. And again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We're taking your questions and comments about just what cancer looks like here in the Granite State, what the leading types of cancer are affecting people here in New Hampshire. Next week, we'll look more at treatment, cure, and paying for cancer care. And Judy, let's look at another aspect of cancer now, the idea of cancer clusters. There was concern for a couple of years now on the seacoast about this. Residents of five towns there have been for some time worried about kids with cancer. Earlier this year, the Department of Health and Human Services confirmed there was a pediatric cancer cluster in the five-town area. With us now is Thomas Sherman. He's a Democratic state representative from Ryan, Newcastle, and a gastroenterologist with Exeter Hospital's Center for Cancer Care. And Dr. Sherman, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Just a couple basics, Dr. Sherman. First, what are the five towns? How many kids? What kinds of cancer?
The five towns are Portsmouth, Newcastle, Northampton, Rye, and Greenland are the ones in the cluster group. The number of kids, there's actually two kinds of cancer that have been found to be fit the definition of cluster, and there's one is a genetic cancer called pleuropulmonary blastoma, or PPB, and the other one is rhabdomyosarcoma, or RMS. And in those cases, Department of Health and Human Services quantifies them or puts a number of less than five. And the reason they do that is when you get down into very tiny numbers or very small numbers, you have a risk of actually identifying people. And so department rules require that they stay less than five rather than give an actual number.
I don't really understand that. Why can't they give an actual number?
It's department rules. And so whenever you're looking at statistics and population statistics and you localize into a and you bring it down to a geographic area, that's one identifier. And then if you're saying, well, there's only one person who has it, that actually puts that person at risk of being identifiable personally, which
I see.
In an age of HIPAA and all the other rules against personal identification, any kind of statistical identification, when you get super small numbers, you end up with a risk of that. And so it's actually departmental rules that they cannot give the exact number.
So what is a cluster then? What's the actual definition of a cancer cluster? It sounds very scary.
It can be. And certainly for the parents and for the children, it is beyond scary.
Sure.
So a cancer cluster is defined by a ratio of the actual number of patients identified over the expected number in a similar locale or, you know, grouping. So what the department did was they looked at what is the actual number, which was less than five, and what is the anticipated number, and that's less than one.
I see.
And statistically, that works out to being significant. And so that defines a cluster. And it was true in both types of cancers.
So the question is why this number of pediatric cancers in this particular area? Is there something in the water, in the air, in the bedrock, or what?
Yeah, exactly. My hat goes off to a few of the residents, actually many of the residents of the area. They were both concerned and persistent. And people like Mindy Mesmer and Elisa Bolton really were the first ones to point this out to the department, and I started working with them and the department about 2 years ago. And the department then launched its probe or its study to see whether that was whether there was actually grounds for concern.
And so, what are your hopes, Dr. Sherman, as this goes forward in terms of, you know, how this task force continues? What specifically it looks at? What are you hoping for?
Well, it's best described by one of the people from the department, and I like her analogy. If you think of it as two different swim lanes, and in one swim lane, you're thinking of all the health outcomes, so rhabdomyosarcoma, PPB, those are the ones we can actually measure, but with the recent discovery in Coakley landfill of PFCs and the PFCs being present at peas, and as well as Merrimack and Litchfield and other places around the country, the concern then sort of broadens. There's a strong association between PFCs and, testicular cancer, kidney cancer, thyroid disease, ulcerative colitis.
So you're looking for triggers that may have caused this.
Right. So one swim lane is what are the health outcomes, and that includes the two clusters. And the Department of Health and Human Services has formed what's called a CAG, which is a community advisory group. And that is a group that is actually looking at what should be in a questionnaire for the people who have been affected. So the parents and the children who have had the actual cancer, they look at all aspects of exposure, both in their personal lives, where they lived. And then the other swim lane is what are the actual environmental exposures? So we have Pease, we have the Naval Shipyard, we have the Schiller Power Plant, we have the Seabrook Power Plant, and we have Coakley Landfill.
Wow, there's a lot to look at.
Yeah, a lot to look at. And it's basically air, water, and soil. And that's so the idea of the task force, I approached the governor back in March, partially because we were having so many meetings of concerned residents, Department of Environmental Services, EPA, and Department of Health and Human Services were going to all of these different meetings, and it just seemed that we needed a central focus for communication and collaboration, and I think also for making sure the investigation is thorough. And that's where the concept of the task force came in.
Well, Dr. Sherman, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
You bet.
That's Thomas Sherman, Democratic State Representative from Rye in Newcastle and a gastroenterologist with Exeter Hospital's Center for Cancer Care, talking about concerns of a cancer cluster, a pediatric cancer cluster on the seacoast. Just a couple last questions for you, Judy Reese. First of all, you know, Dr. Sherman talked about things people are looking at, air, water, soil. You almost feel like throwing up your hands and saying, you know, what can I do? I mean, you got to eat, you got to breathe, you got to drink.
Yeah, this is a really difficult cancer cluster investigation because, it's a very important cancer cluster investigation. This is a rare cancer, and any cancer in children, you want to do as much as you can to find out what's causing it and put a stop to it if that's possible. So one of the difficulties here is that we don't know very much about this particular cancer, RMS. It's a rare cancer. Even national studies haven't really provided us with much information about the risk factors, and certainly not specific risk factors, for example, if you're looking at a landfill. So that's one issue, is there's no lead that we can actually grasp onto and try to assess. The next thing is, if we're looking for one of 1,000 different environmental exposures out there, how do we know which one it is?
Right. How do you figure that out?
It could be one of the ones that Dr. Sherman mentioned at a landfill, or it could be something different, which we haven't even identified yet. So identifying, what we should be studying is a real problem. And then the next problem is that we're looking literally at a handful of cases. And statistically, when you have that few a number, it becomes a very difficult investigation. So there's a lot of legwork and brain work going into this to try and work out how we can best approach it. And it's actually very helpful to have the community groups and the DHHS groups working both together and separately to try and figure it out. So there's a lot of effort going into this investigation. But it is a little bit of a struggle to try and work out the best way to actually come up with an answer.
Well, we talked a lot this hour, Judy, about New Hampshire's cancer rates, the rates at which people are diagnosed with cancer. How does New Hampshire do with 5-year survival rates after a diagnosis of cancer? That's when people can start to feel like they're out of the woods, right?
Right. So interestingly, the incidence, which is number of new cases, that's high here. The mortality is a little high, but it's not as high as you would expect if all those new cases went on to progress in the same way that they do in the rest of the country. So if we look at 5-year survival, we find that New Hampshire actually does very well. And Whereas we're in the top 10 for new cases and mortality, we're actually in the top 10 for five-year survival, which seems a little bit of a paradox.
Yes, I'm still trying to figure that out. Go ahead.
So after a diagnosis of cancer, roughly, and this is highly variable according to what the type of cancer is and the stage and so on and how fit the patient is, but roughly two-thirds of cancer patients are alive 5 years after the diagnosis. But in New Hampshire, we have a couple of percentage points above that, so we're actually doing a lot better. And that applies to most of the different types of cancer that we look at survival figures for. So I can't tell you why the survival is so much better in New Hampshire. There could be a lot of different reasons, from diagnosing people earlier to having good access to high-quality care. There are a lot of reasons why, but it's encouraging that we're doing so well.
Well, and that's what we'll talk about next Wednesday, cancer treatment, survival, and, of course, the ongoing search for a cure. Judy Rees, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's Judy Rees, director of the New Hampshire Cancer Registry and an assistant professor of epidemiology at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Jessica Hunt. Our intern is Sam Ruthier. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.